The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Splendor of the Byzantine Empire, is dedicated to the honor and merit of the Milman family. There's an old saying that all roads lead to Rome. Although only a faint memory today, with crumbling ruins bearing its silent testimony, there was a time that the Roman Empire stretched from the Atlantic Ocean to the Persian Gulf and encompassed much of the civilized Western world. The majority of world Jewry were at one time part of that empire. This vast and powerful empire was controlled from one central place, the city of Rome. Over the course of the hundreds of years since its zenith under the Emperor Trajan in the year 117, the empire, challenged by enemies from all sides, gradually became smaller and smaller until it finally collapsed in Western Europe and North Africa. What remained was situated in Eastern Europe and Western Asia. The capital of this Eastern Roman Empire, known as the Byzantine Empire, was Byzantium, or Constantinople, what is today Istanbul, Turkey. The official language of this empire was no longer Latin, but Greek. It remained Roman in name only. Yet until the middle of the 11th century, this reduced Roman Empire was still the most powerful state in Europe. In an era when Western Europe experiences dark ages, the Byzantine Empire produced an extensive literature together with treasured works of art and architecture that are studied and admired to this day. The Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox churches, together with the Armenian, Coptic, and Nestorian churches, receive their present-day forms in the environment of the religious ferment of the Byzantine Empire. The policies of the Byzantine emperors and the deep political division between Christian and non-Christian worlds had a deep and lasting effect on Jewish practice and customs. The story of the Byzantine Empire and its legacy is the topic of tonight's lecture. I would like to begin with a short history of the fall of the Western Roman Empire and development of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire. We're going to constantly refer back to the timeline, which you have at the end, and perhaps maybe it's good for you to look at it as we're talking right now. This is in the last page. As we stated before, the Roman Empire reached its zenith under the Emperor Trajan. And that's the first entry. In the east, his empire included Mesopotamia, the area that's today's Iraq. I mean, everyone knows about the Tsoras there. In the area of today's Eastern Europe, it extended to the province of Dacia, the area north of the Danube and the Black Sea, encompassing much of what is today's Romania, Moldova, and southern Ukraine and Russia. After Trajan's death in the year 117, the Emperor Hadrian realized the empire had grown too large to be successfully defended. The Roman legions began an orderly retreat and ceded back the recently conquered areas of Mesopotamia and Dacia. The river Danube now became the northern border of the eastern part of the empire, and we're going to constantly refer to this. So the empire, which is already reduced, its northern limit was the Danube River. Its eastern limit included Syria and Palestine, but did not go to today's Iraq. Armenia was constantly changing hands. In the succeeding years after Trajan's death, this reduced Roman Empire was beset by continuous attacks on all fronts. In the east were the Persians. In the year 260, under the leadership of Shapur I, or he's known in the Talmud as Shovar Malka, The Persians, after conquering Armenia and eastern Syria, capture the Roman Emperor Valerian. Nothing has been heard about him since. In the north were the Goths, a Germanic tribe. They were constantly a threat in the Balkans and Italy. The Balkans is what is today Bosnia, which is constantly revolting as is, and Italy. Time and again, they were driven back across the Danube, the Roman Empire's northern border. By the year 284, and as you see in your outline, you'll see, when the Emperor Diocletian, one of the Romans' most capable leaders, came to the throne, the empire was in disarray. Inflation was rampant, the army understaffed and cumbersome, and the administration of the empire grossly misrun. Upon reaching the throne, Diocletian doubled his military by increasing pay, and thereby making military service more appealing. That's, by the way, that's what they did when they created an all-volunteer force here in the United States. He also reorganized the military, making it more mobile. In order to attack inflation, basically he made the same mistake Richard Nixon did. He raised taxes to pay for his new military expenses and fixed prices and wages. Realizing that the empire was too large to be defended and administrated by one man alone, he appointed in the year 286, remember he came to the throne 284, it took him 2 years to realize it's Soros, he appointed a colleague, Maximian, to become his co-emperor. Later in the year 297, again, it was too tough for two people, they each appointed junior partners by the name of Galerius and Constantius. The senior partners were each given the title Augustus, like August. These junior partners each had the title Caesar. So they divided, as usually was, used to be one, now it became two. The plan was when the senior partners, the Augusti, would retire, which they did in the year 305, the junior partner, the Caesars, would now become the senior partners, and they in turn would appoint junior partners. Each partner, junior and senior, were given separate areas to administrate. Thus, it wasn't just like we have today, a vice president does nothing. But they work on the environment, but really they were not only named successors, but they actually had areas of real responsibility. There were now four powerful administrators, and they were called tetrarchs, with the Roman thing for four, tetra, running the empire, each administrating a different district, and there were now provisions in place for a smooth transition and succession. In addition, Diocletian, who was basically the main emperor of the throne, also reorganized the provincial administrations, and those would be the equivalent of the states here, revamping them and making them more efficient. Despite his bold moves, he did not achieve the success he longed for. Diocletian learned the difficult lesson that artificially tampering with the economy does not lead to stability. The Wall Street Journal constantly says this, by the way. In fact, there was an article about Diocletian. In the wake of his fixing prices and wages, there was hoarding, a proliferation of black markets, and rioting. Although his tetrarchy system of having four partners to run the empire worked fairly well while he was in office, shortly after his retirement in the year 305, civil war broke out for the dominance of the western part of the empire. In the year 312, the emperor Constantine finally defeated his rival Maxentius, and we're going to hear about Constantine soon, and became Western Roman Emperor. The Arch of Constantine in Rome was built as a tribute to that victory. So there are, it is one of the few arches left in Rome, and it's really, he became now the Western Roman Emperor. In the year 324, he was on a roll, Constantine defeated the Eastern Emperor, Licinius, and once again the empire was ruled by a single emperor. So then just again, you see, you have in your time, and we had We had Trajan, which marked the greatest extent of the empire. We came to Diocletian, where it was already reduced and there's all kinds of tsuras. And he decided, well, let's divide it up, make it better that way. But the kind of person who becomes the Roman emperor is the kind of person we call a type A personality. They're very difficult to live with. Constantine, after many wars and many killings and battles, became the single Roman emperor. By this time, the city of Rome had already lost its preeminence among the cities of the empire and merely functioned as a provincial capital. It was a capital in name only. In fact, during the first 20 years of his reign, Diocletian never even entered the city of Rome, as he ran the empire far away from the capital. Constantine, realizing the economic and strategic importance of the Eastern Empire, built a second capital, which would be the real capital, a new Rome, at the site of the ancient city of Byzantium, and called it Constantinople, or Constantine's Opal, like what Paul is, Constantine's city. It's located, it's too bad we don't have a map here. There are two major bodies of water in that area. This is in the western part, in the northwestern part of Asia. There's the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. The Black Sea is the northwest border. In between those two seas, there's a fairly narrow body of water. First, there's coming from the Mediterranean, there's the Straits of the Dardanelles. Now, there's that strait leads to a little sea called the Sea of Marmara, and in turn leads to another strait, the Strait of the Bosporus. So you have the major seas. You have the Mediterranean, you have the men in the north, in the northwest, you have the Black Sea, and you have this these little straits and this little sea and this little strait connecting them. Constantinople is by the Bosporus, right by the Black Sea. The one who controls that city controls the entrance to the Black Sea, the division between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. Historically, Turkey controlling that area as the Black Sea enters the Bosporus, controlled Russia. Russia never had an outlet to the Mediterranean. Russia, many of its ports are on the Black Sea. Crimea was borders the Black Sea. Odessa, there's so many of people have taken the boat trip from Odessa through the Black Sea, finally through the Straits to Eretz Yisrael, had no legal way, the people, the boats from Odessa, going into the Mediterranean. Baruch Hashem. Thank God the Russians didn't get to the Mediterranean. But it was controlled by the Turks all these years, who controlled the straits. They could go into the Black Sea, but because of the Turks, the Russians couldn't go any further. And that's, by the way, why the United States, had Turkey as part of NATO. To control that vital strait and make sure that the Russians don't go any further. Constantine felt this is a great place to have a capital. It's right, in other words, it's technically part of, it's really technically part of Asia. This is really the northwest tip of Asia. But if you go across the Bosporus, which is not too long, you're in Europe. Because it really is the border. This whole thing, the Mediterranean, if you look at the Mediterranean, the Straits of Dardanelles, there's the Sea of Marmara, this Bosporus, and then the Black Sea, are all as a large body of water that separates Asia from Europe. So says Ezekiel, this is the place, and that's where he built his city. And it's through there, says, that he could have access to everything that's in Asia. It was the center of the communications of land from Asia, as he would know what's doing in Asia, and he would know what's doing in Europe. And also, says, the Danube River, which empties into that area, which was the northern border, was right by, Constantinople. So this is where he decided to place his capital. It also had an additional advantage. In the eastern part of the empire was where Christianity was born, and it was the most powerful. Christianity was the religion that Constantine himself embraced. And therefore he felt his capital would be in the Christian part of his empire. He spent great wealth there. There was already a city there, Byzantium. He robbed the pagan shrines of the statues and columns. As he emptied it out. He rebuilt it, those things into churches. Made it a magnificent city and cleansed it of its pagan past. He created a Christian city. After Constantine's reign, the empire, he was a, it seems in terms of generalship, we have Diocletian as one, and Constantine as another, as a great general who was able to defend the empire. After his death, though, again, the enemies were besieging it from all sides. In fact, in the year 363, this is after the death of Constantine's son and successor, the Emperor Julian, in a campaign against the Persians, was killed in battle. In the year 378, the Eastern Emperor Valens, as again they tried to separate him between Eastern and Western, was killed while he was attempting to drive back the Goths who had crossed the Danube. Realizing the weakness of the empire and the futility of Constantine driving back the tribes that crossed its borders, his successor Theodosius I, and should be in your timeline, saved the situation temporarily by officially allowing the Goths to settle in the Balkan provinces, the provinces south of the Danube. In other words, he figured, says, they did not have the strength to constantly push back the German tribes. And he felt the best policy would be to let them settle and make them quasi-citizens. Now, it's better to have the enemy under your control than have them far away from you constantly attacking. And this made a major change in the empire. Because now the Goths, who were the previous enemies, were actually confederates. And at times of war, they actually became soldiers as part of the rush of the Roman armies fighting other enemies. So they absorbed these people, and of course the most talented amongst them themselves became officers and generals. But as a result, the Roman Empire army became less and less Roman and more German. Theodosius was the last single ruler of both East and West. After his death, the empire was divided again between his two sons, Arcadius in the East and Honorius in the West. And these names, and as we have, remember, Constantine, Theodosius, this Arcadius and Honorius will appear again and again in this lecture. Unlike their father Theodosius, who was a general, the two brothers were not soldiers and had to rely on their generals, because they themselves were not truly the commanders of the army. And those generals were often not even Romans. They were Germans. Through the years, this had been a total change in the makeup of the army. The commander-in-chief of Honorius's, and this Honorius was the Western Empire, his capital was Rome, was Stilicho. He was a Vandal, as he came from the Vandals, one of the Germanic tribes. His greatest adversary was Alaric, a Gothic chieftain, who was officially a general in the Roman army, but who wanted to have his own independence. And Alaric waged campaigns against Rome for over a decade. And it was Stilicho who kept on pushing him back. So it was really, it wasn't just the Germans against the Romans, it was like Germans against Germans. In the year 410, and again you'll see on your timeline, shortly after the death of Stilicho, and that was Honorius' commander-in-chief, again, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will play, Alaric says, invaded Italy. And was at the head of a German army and marched on Rome. And for 3 days, the Gothic army plundered the city before it left. As this was the beginning of the fall of Rome. This is the year 410. So again, we had it, and let's just go over the timeline, we keep on getting the details again and again, just to have your sense of what's happening in history. 117th was the zenith. It was the Roman Empire was at its largest. And from them, after the death of Trajan, it started shrinking. It immediately, they gave up Iraq, they immediately gave up Romania. By the time Diocletian came, which is over 150 years later, Rome had a tough time controlling even this reduced empire. And that's why he decided to see too big for one man. He divided it up into different areas, the east and the west. And for many years afterwards, we had this constant division. Sometimes it was by one person. Constantine was one person. Theodosius was one person. But other times, it was really divided up into different rulers. 45 years later, the city of Rome was again plundered. This time it was the Vandals, another Germanic tribe, who were at that time in control of North Africa. And as they had come down, you know, from where they were, you know, in those areas of Germany, had crossed the Mediterranean, had conquered North Africa, used as a base, came back from North Africa, and attacked Rome. Incidentally, among the Roman treasures that had brought back to their base in North Africa were the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, the Second Temple. This was part, when they sacked Rome, part of what they took were the vessels of the temple. Finally, in the year 476, the Western Roman Empire collapsed entirely, when the last Roman emperor, Romulus Augustulus, was deposed by Odoacer, another German officer, who proclaimed himself king of Italy. As these Germans were not cultured, as it's not like the Germans who created the Holocaust, they weren't cultured, they were barbarians. They didn't have any pretenses. And the barbarians now ruled the former Western Empire. So really, it was really controlled now by Germans. And the Romans, who were, let's say, those with culture, actually now controlled the East. Europe, Western Europe, was now plunged into the Dark Ages. It was controlled by barbarians. It took them many years until basically the culture that originally was the culture of Greece and Rome again reappeared in Europe. The Eastern Empire, however, continued the heritage of Rome and continued to be a bastion of Roman, Greek, and Christian learning till its fall almost 1,000 years later in the year 1453. Just to put this into perspective, in the year 425 was when Rav Ashi, the editor, the major editor of the Talmud, dies. So the Talmudic era is within these years. The year 455, the Vandals sack Rome. Amongst the things they took were the vessels of the temple. 476 is the fall of the Roman Empire, and it also is the same year when the last of the great sages of the Talmud, Ravina, dies. The era of the Amoraim, of the great Talmudic sages, comes to an end. So in a sense, when Rome as we know it comes to an end, at least the Western Empire, so too, says, is the era of the completion of the Talmud. The Eastern Empire reached its zenith under the emperor Justinian. And again, if you look at the timeline, Justinian was from the year 527 to the year 565. It's almost 40 years, 38 years. He was an able leader, blessed with brilliant generals. Under his administration from the years that we have here in the timeline, the Vandals of North Africa were vanquished, as well as the Goths in Italy. He expanded the Eastern Empire. Now it included North Africa, and it included Italy. It did not include France, though. It did not include Great Britain. It did not include Spain. He brought just the southwestern portion of Spain, you know, was under his control, because with that he controlled the western straits of the Mediterranean. The eastern border of his empire, bordered Persia, was attacked constantly by the Persians, but he successfully defended those borders. But his most lasting accomplishments were in the fields of law and architecture. The Justinian Code, the foremost compilation of Roman law and legal opinion, was compiled under his auspices. The Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, which Justinian commissioned, is one of the most extraordinary and magnificent structures ever built. After the fall of Constantinople, it was taken over by the Turks, who converted it into a mosque. After the independence of Turkey, it was again converted into a museum. In the half century after his death, though, much of Justinian's military gains were reversed. Northern Italy was overrun by the Lombards. The Balkans were overrun by the Slavs. This is why Bosnia and Serbia and the other Balkan states are primarily Slavic. They're Slavic because after his lifetime, this is in the end of the 6th century, it was overrun by the Slavs. By the middle of the reign of Heraclius, who came to the throne in 610, as we have this, you have this in the timeline, and again, this puts us now, this is the period of the Gaonim. If you just see the first Gaon of Sura, the Gaon of Pumpedisa. The eastern provinces were entirely overrun by the Persians. Although he gained these provinces back after defeating the Persians in the year 628, the fruits of his victory over the Persians were shortly savored, as the Arabs soon overran Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. And here we find, here if you again in the timeline, where the Persians ruled Syria and Palestine for 14 years, the Byzantines wrested control from the Persians, but in 634 the Arab conquest began, and soon, this is all of those lands of Syria and below became Arab, and that's why they speak Arabic. Up until that time, in Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, they spoke Greek. Even Anatolia, which is Turkish Asia, was repeatedly attacked by the Arabs and their later successors, the Seljuk Turks. Although the Byzantine Empire had somewhat a revival at the end of the 10th and beginning of the 11th century under Basil II, and again to the timeline, its final years were years of relative decline. If you see, notice in 1204, and this is connected with the whole Crusades. The Latins, meaning the Western powers, they're called Latins because in Constantinople they spoke Greek. And the church was the Roman Catholic Church. They sacked Constantinople and they made a special Catholic kingdom in that area. They were eventually driven out, but in 1453, and this is the last entry, the Ottoman Turks finally conquered the Byzantine Empire. And that was the end of the Byzantine Empire. They tolerated the practice of Christianity, but by and large it went into recession in Turkey itself, even though in Greece they still maintained themselves as Christians. Let's go over again quickly this timeline to proceed in the, again, because there's a lot of information, but I want you to get a feel of what happened. Again, in 117, the Roman Empire was at its zenith. After the death of Trajan in 117, they lost Iraq and Romania and southern Russia. In the year 284, since they had Diocletian try to remedy the situation, took hold of it, revamped it, divided it up into a to the east and west. Constantine first became, after the death and after many struggles, first became the Western Emperor, became the Eastern Emperor. He was the sole emperor in 324, but he built the city of Constantinople. Again, after his death, they tried to have an Eastern and Western Emperor. It was difficult. Theodosius stepped in the year 379, became the sole emperor, but again, after he died, it went back into two. Again, I keep on repeating this idea of one Eastern-Western, because we deal with the Byzantine Empire, that's the Eastern Empire. And this Western Empire eventually was lost. And this is in 410, Alaric plunders Rome, and 455, the Vandals sack Rome. Not much is left of Rome. And the final fall of the Western Roman Empire was in the year 476. It was a German, Italy was a German state. The Balkans were German states. That which was we considered Roman, even though the language was Greek, but they considered as a continuation of the Roman emperors, was already in Turkey. It was already in the East. In Justinian's time, the East expands. They conquer Italy, they conquer North Africa, they even take a portion of Spain, the southwestern portion which controlled the Straits of Gibraltar. But after his death, those gains are reversed. And if you turn down to year 610, there's a reign of Heraclius, who was one of the stronger Byzantine emperors. But soon afterwards, he lost Syria and Palestine to the Persians. He finally gained them back, but again it was lost to the Arabs. And the fall, the final fall of the Byzantine Empire in the year 1453. So you see an empire which was in constant attack. They tried to divide it, in other words, to make it more manageable. What happened was eventually they lost the western half, they kept the eastern half, and eventually the eastern half itself eventually crumbled. But the history of the Roman and Byzantine Empire is not just a history, is not just a military and political history. It's closely tied with the history of Christianity. Great controversies surrounding basic Christian beliefs had the people, clergy, and rulers of the Byzantine Empire in a state of unrest for hundreds of years. It would be helpful to supply a little background. Let it not be said that we just teach Judaism. The basis of Christianity is the belief that the suffering and crucifixion of Yeshu was the source of redemption of mankind. But not all mankind, only for those that believe. Those who believe in him and his redemptive powers will be saved. The others will be damned to purgatory or hell. The reason Yeshu, of all people, was the elect to bring mankind to the state of perfection is because he, according to Christian belief and based on New Testament writings, was the Son of God. It goes without saying that this belief is contrary to Judaism, but is also contrary to reason and to the plain reading of the Old Testament that ultimately forms the basis for the Christian belief in a Messiah and redemption. The first problem is that there is another deity besides Hashem, besides the one God, then there are two gods. Basically, you would normally think that either it's one or two. One of the basic tenets of belief as expressed in the Torah is Shema Yisrael. We say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord. This is the Lord. This is Hashem Elokeinu. This is Hashem, the Lord, is our God. Hashem Echad, the Lord is one. But if there's a father and a son, it strains the idea of how is it one. This problem is compounded by the official belief accepted by Orthodox Christians and Catholics that there are three parts of God, not just two. There's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. And this is known as the Trinity. Now, again, is there one, is there two, or is there three? Okay, that's one problem. Besides, there's an additional problem of logic. If there's a Father and a Son, and they're both gods, again, there's but one God, right? And again, there's a Father and there's a Son, but there's only one God. Therefore, logically, the Father and the Son are synonymous. But how can one be a Father and a Son at the same time? I mean, there's a problem here. There was a priest in Alexandria by the name of Arius. His solution was that the Son was produced by the Father, and there was a time that the Son was not yet in existence. In other words, Yeshu, or the Son, was created. There's really only one God. I mean, at least there was one God. And this one God created a second God. Now, Arius' beliefs became widespread, especially among the Germanic tribes, who had no problem with one God fathering another God. I mean, the concept is as old as German mythology. But, of course, this belief ran counter to Christian orthodoxy and the biblical belief in one God, not two, because if there's one God, means that's it. Others are angels, they're shaluchim, they're emissaries, but there's only one in control. So Orthodox Christians, the belief in a created son was a form of paganism. The first church council, this is an ecumenical church council, and he's calling bishops from all across the Roman Empire. Bishops had different dioceses, and those are different areas of their control. They brought them together to deal with this issue of Arius. And this was brought together by the Emperor Constantine in the year 325 in Nicaea. The conclusion of that council, what they voted was that Arius's belief was actually heresy. Another council was convened by the Emperor Theodosius. Remember Theodosius? And this was in Constantinople in 381. Evidently, as soon as they take charge, they evidently they make these church councils. First, you know, Constantine, and then Theodosius. And he had the ability, because he was solely in charge, it was a lot easier for him to do this. This belief of Arianism did not go away so fast. In fact, as you said, the Germanic tribes still were Arians, and they were not called Orthodox Christians. The word Orthodox, by the way, does not mean just in terms of Jews. Ortho means correct, like orthopedic, in other words, correct feet. Ortho means correct. Dox means belief. And the Orthodox were those who felt they had the correct belief. And that's why it's the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, they call them Orthodox because they're not heretics. Theodosius, again, in 381 in Constantinople, convened another ecumenical council to reaffirm the belief in the oneness and eternity of the so-called parts of the Trinity. And it's really in this council was formulated what's called the Nicene Creed of the people who believe in the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. It started there. And they are all one. It's accepted not only by Catholics and Orthodox, as Russian and Greek Orthodox, but by Lutherans, Anglicans, and Presbyterians. Even though many of them do not accept the conclusion of some of the other church councils, but this is accepted. And by the way, most halachic opinions maintain that this belief in a multifaceted, uncreated, and eternal Godhead is still a form of paganism. And according to most opinions, even this belief that went away from Arius, and this Arius would certainly be considered paganism because it's a created god. I mean, this is like the gods of Mount Olympus creating other gods. But here it's a eternal godhead, it's still a form of paganism. There's, of course, another logical difficulty with the church faced. Again, so the first one was, is it one or two or three? The nun was, Yeshu was a human. I mean, he looked like it anyway. He was born of a mother. He walked, talked, ate, slept. Seems so. Yet at the same time, he was supposed to be divine. It's like, who was running the world? You know, in other words, was he human or was he divine? Again, this was an issue that the church struggled with. There was a bishop in Constantinople by the name of Nestorius who argued there were actually two distinct Yeshus. There was the human, he was a person. And he was controlled, manipulated or whatever it is, by a god. There's the son. And there's, they look as really in God in heaven, there's a father and a son. And that son, that part of the god, controlled this human by the name of Yeshu. So there are two of them, a divine one and a human one. Mary, the mother of Yeshu, he argued, was the mother of the human Yeshu and not the divine. As the Orthodox maintain he's the mother of the divine Yeshu. I know this seems a little odd to you, but you know these issues meant and still mean a lot to millions of people to this day. Again, the entire church officially convened a third council of bishops. This time it was in Ephesus against Turkey in the year 431. Again, struggling with a contradiction of scripture and logic, the council declared the belief of Nestorius to be heretical, and that the two natures, divine and human, were perfectly united in Yeshu. In other words, he was a human, and he was divine, and he was all one, and you think you have problems. The Nestorians, however, did not recognize the decree of the council and broke away from the main body of Catholics and Orthodox. And they formed their own church. Now that there are not many of them left, but there was a time that the Nestorian church was a very powerful church. There was yet another group that took a completely polar stance to Nestorius. They were the Monophysites. They believed that Yeshu did not have two distinct natures, because, I mean, there's a human and there's a divine, and there's the one who's eternal, and there's the one who was just born from a mother. But he had only one nature. The human was a manifestation of the divine. Again, the bishops of Christendom met to deal with this new heresy. Remember, we mentioned three councils already. Nicaea, Constantinople, that ruled on Arianism. There's that he's not a created god, but he's an eternal god. Ephesus ruled on Nestorianism, that the human and the divine are all one. This fourth was convened in Chalcedon, again in Turkey, in the year 451, and the council rejected monophysism. In other words, that he has really two separate natures. And the statement of faith that came out of him, Chalcedon, was that Yeshu had two natures, divine and human, quote, without confusion, without change, without division, end quote. Perfectly united in a single person. A concept, of course, that defies all logic. The Monophysites, who comprised much of the Egyptian, Armenian, and Syrian Christendom, could not be easily rejected or placated. But there were many attempts of reconciliation. A compromise position between the Monophysites and the Orthodox was worked out by the Emperor Heraclius, remember? He was in 610, he came to the... In the year 624, he worked out this compromise and was approved by Pope Honorius I. According to this compromise position, called monophyleticism, this is the compromise. It's been said that a camel is a horse that was designed by a committee. Yeshu had two distinct natures, like the Chalcedine dogma. In other words, there's a human and there's a human. But had one will. In other words, the one who made the decisions was the one on top. The one below didn't make any decisions. It was like the Manchurian candidate, you know. And it was controlled from higher up. This compromise won the support of the Egyptian and Armenian monophysites. This compromise was subsequently rejected by the Third Council of Constantinople in 680, and Pope Honorius was condemned for endorsing this compromise. This by the fact that the Pope was condemned creates another theological problem for the Church, because it was the feeling of the Church, and it was finally made in part of Church doctrine over 200 years ago, was the Pope is infallible. So how could an infallible Pope be condemned for endorsing a heretical doctrine? Okay, they have their problems. But again, the final declaration of this council, this other council in Constantinople, was that Yeshu had two wills, one human, one divine, without division and without confusion. So let me just summarize. There are four major issues. First, was the Son created or was he always coexistent with the Father? Arianism held that the Son was created and this was condemned at Nicaea 325. And again in Constantinople in 381 that officially embraced the idea of Trinity. Second, was Yeshu separately divine and human, or was he both without confusion or division? Nestorians held that he was separate, and that belief was condemned in Ephesus in 431. Thirdly, did he have two distinct natures, but mysteriously they're actually one without confusion or division, or did he have but one nature? The monophysites held that he had one nature. They were condemned in Chalcedon in 451. Did he have two wills without confusion or division, or one? The monolithists maintained that he had but one will. They were condemned at Constantinople in 680. Remember, you heard this at Mahon. Yeah. In addition to the internal schisms we outlined, there were in addition two which were very noteworthy as well. The first is the conflict regarding statues or images. In the year 726, the Byzantine Empire, Leo III, began a campaign to eliminate images of Yeshu. These images are also called icons, not the ones on your computer. And it was fiercely opposed by Rome. The Roman Catholics argued that since Yeshu came down to earth in human form, venerating the icon was a confession of faith in Yeshu's humanity and divinity. The opponents claimed that it's akin to idolatry. Savoy de Zora. Over a hundred years from its inception, in the year 843, the iconoclastic movement, the movement to rid Christianity of images, finally came to an end. This event is celebrated to this day in the Orthodox Church. There were other strains in Christendom as well. The Roman Catholics looked at the Pope as a singular leader of all of the Christian world. The Orthodox maintained there were several regional leaders amongst Christians. The Patriarch of Constantinople, the Patriarch of Alexandria, the Patriarch of Antioch, the Patriarch of Jerusalem. To those of the Eastern churches, the Pope was merely the Patriarch of Rome. Perhaps the first among equals, but certainly not the sole head of the Church. This issue, together with other strains, created what is known as the Great Schism of the Church. In the year 1054, the Orthodox Church broke from the Roman Catholic Church. Although much of the internal controversy of the Church, which we've covered, seems very arcane, I felt it was important to go over this for three reasons. One, the controversy surrounding Church doctrine is much part of the history of the Byzantine Empire, as is the political and military conflicts that were explained at the beginning of this class. They had political problems or military problems. There were internal problems of belief. And it was really, there were civil wars. I mean, there were people, these issues were not just
debated, you know, this is in the in ivory towers by academicians and scholars. These were really the stuff that people went to war for. Secondly, these controversies gave us a greater appreciation of the logical difficulties of Christianity and the tremendous energies that went into the formulation of doctrine and the battle for the dominance of the verses against the various heresies and orthodoxies of early Christendom. So just important just to have an understanding from a historical viewpoint of the what we call the creation of Christianity. What went into what the doctrine is today. And thirdly, it gives understanding of the tremendous chesed that Hashem did for us, the kindness that God did for us. And let me explain. If you look in the beginning of the turn to the first page of the handout, and this is we've gone through previous years, we've gone over this idea, and I'll repeat this. I'll just summarize this idea. The Torah describes the struggle of two twin brothers. It says Yaakov, Jacob, and Esav, Esau. It was predicted that these two brothers would struggle, says, not only in their own lifetimes, but in their lifetimes of their children and children's children forever. Esav created a kingdom called Edom. A descendant of Esav created the kingdom which was in Italy, which was in Rome. In other words, at least partially, the Romans were descendants of Esav, and the struggle between Esav and Yaakov turned to be the struggle between Jerusalem and Rome. And you have, just you could look in your own thing on page, we quoted this in the previous lecture, on the first page, this is from the Ramban, this is paragraph C, about how Tsepho, who was a grandson of Esav, came to settle in Rome. Rome itself as a city, as a village and as a city, grew as a fulfillment of the biblical prediction that when Jacob falters morally, then Esav, the other brother, will have the upper hand. That area became settled. This is the southern part of Italy. It became settled, says that, I guess that it, some of it must have been under sea or under marshland. It says the angel Gabriel planted a reed in the sea and silt settled around that area. It says when King Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh and idolatry was introduced to the Jewish nation. Later on, when the two golden calves were introduced in the time of Jeroboam, not some 40 years after Solomon's time, says a hut was built in the area around Rome. This was the very beginnings of Rome. When the Jews falter morally, the Romans says are physically successful. But not only is there this struggle between Rome and Jerusalem, but Rome has had tremendous influences on other nations. So we have this struggle of Rome against Jerusalem. What stops Rome from destroying Jerusalem? It destroyed it in the destruction of the Second Temple. It destroyed it in terms of the destruction of the fortress of Beitar when there was a Jewish revolt some 70 years after the destruction of the the Second Temple. But what stops them from constantly destroying us? And there on top of page 3 we bring, says, what stops them from destroying us, says, and this is paragraph H on page 3, is the difficulties they have. There are 300 crowned heads in Germany, Germania of Edom. There are 365 chieftains in Rome. every day one sets forth to meet the other and one of them is killed. This is, of course, an allegory, but it refers to the fact Germany is always fighting Rome. They're so busy fighting each other, they don't have time to fight the Jews. When the Romans were so involved militarily fighting off their enemies, the Goths or the Persians, or they were busy fighting internally, in terms of if you believed like Arius, or you believe like the Orthodox, if you believe like the Monophysites, or you believe like the Orthodox. These internal struggles took much of the emotional energy of the Romans, devoted it against these heretics, and they didn't think that much about the Jews. So understanding what their struggles were helps us perhaps understanding they had so much sorrows. This is Baruch Hashem, thank God, says the Jews were at least partially spared. But as we said before, the Roman, when we refer to Romans, it's not only the physical descendants, their power is not only felt by the physical descendants of Esav, which is the twin brother of Yaakov. On here on page 3, there's a Medrash, which we quote here on section 2, paragraph A. Edom and the Roman Catholic Church. There is a figure in the war of the four kings, which were defeated by Abraham, by Avraham Avinu. There's an allusion that each one of those four kings represented a kingdom that eventually dominated the Jews. There were the Babylonians, there were there were the Medians, there were the Greeks, and there were the Goyim. Tidal is the king of the Goyim. He is the king of many different nations. He is able to dominate by exerting influence on others. And this refers to Edom, who writes, this is how they interpret this verse, they write through the pressure, this hatred literature against the Jews to all of the nations under their dominance. In other words, the Romans have the power of leverage, of increasing their power by influencing others. And this is why they're called Melech Goyim, and will refer to it is viewed that the domination of the Jews by the Roman Catholic Church or by the Orthodox was the domination of Rome, even though the people that dominated were not necessarily of Roman descent and were not physically, biologically the descendants of Esav, but they were the spiritual descendants. Because it was these people who influenced the mind. It was Esav who influenced their mind. And, of course, it's not for a small reason that it is really that Christianity really had its roots through the Romans in Rome and the Romans in Constantinople. This idea of the struggle, by the way, is viewed not just by Jews but by the Catholics as well. St. Augustine, one of the most revered of the church fathers, refers, and it's worth to quote this, just say how they looked at this struggle. Hear, synagogue, hear, widow, hear, deserted one. I am what you could not be. I am the queen, referring to the church, who has disposed you from your realm. And Jacob took two wives. This is Leah, the older with weaker eyes, typifying the synagogue. Rachel, Rachel, the younger and beautiful, typifying the church. They looked at it as a struggle of two twins, two sisters. And in their literature, and to quote this, in the few minutes we have here, to understand how this struggle continued. And see how they spoke about the synagogue. And it's worthwhile to hear this. To understand, because the people that I quote are some of the most revered names of early Christendom. These are the doctors of the church. These are the early church fathers. These were the people that formed the opinion of Christendom throughout the ages up until the Holocaust. As long as a synagogue has flourished, this is what St. Ambrose of Milan writes, the church has labored. The defeat of the synagogue is the strength of the church. The death of the synagogue is the beginning of the church. The beginning not of nature, not a natural beginning, but of salvation. This is, the synagogue is the enemy. And this is how St. Jerome wrote. St. Jerome is known as the one who took the Masoretic text of the Bible and translated into Latin, the Vulgate edition, which is the official Latin version of the Bible, is translated by St. Jerome. Again, the use of the word saint is, it's similar to a quote I heard of the Harry Truman made. Harry Truman was asked about what he felt about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I don't want to repeat what he said. But they asked him, says, but he received the Nobel Peace Prize. And his reply was, I didn't give it to him. And this is, this is how they are known. This is by Saint Jerome. Holding fast to their ancient anger and violence, still today under the name of the Nazarenes, the Jews in their synagogues blaspheme the Christian flock. Evidently, he refers to Birchas Aminim v'Lamalshinim Alti Sikva, is that they understood this blessing to refer to Christians. And while they slay us, they will their own destruction in the eternal fire. This is the next quote is for St. John Chrysostom. Again, one of the four doctors of the Eastern Church. If then it was a den of thieves, this is on page 4, and was still, when it still ruled the affairs of state, now if one were to call it a brothel, a den of iniquity, an abode of demons or a stronghold and pit of the devil, or whatever, one would be calling it less than it deserves. Evidently, he didn't go to shul very often. And it's understand because of this pressure, and these people just didn't write; they darshened, and as they spoke it in public, these were bishops of the church who had many priests under their influence. It was the Jews had to counter this influence, of course, with a lot of money. And we can understand this background as in one of the decrees issued by the Roman Emperor, says Honorius. Honorius, this is, was a son of Theodosius the First. He said Theodosius the First, remember, was the last one to be a sole emperor of the East and the West. Says he was the Western Roman Emperor. Let no one dare to desecrate or forcibly entering. Prohibit the custom of the Jews in their assembling. There's no one is allowed to desecrate a synagogue, forcibly enter a synagogue, prohibit the custom of the Jews in their assembly, disturb the readings of their prayers in the synagogue, since they should be allowed to retain all their customs in peace, according to their law, without interference of their religion and cult. We decree this, albeit it seems that enough has been stated about this matter in the laws promulgated by past emperors. He had the need to say this. You have an understanding of what was happening. In the year 415, Theodosius II was the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire. The Easterns were much more rabid in their anti-Semitism than the Westerns. We have, this is from the emperor in the year 415, if there be any temples in the country districts, let them be demolished without disturbance or tumult. So in other words, as long as it's quiet, we should destroy every synagogue, basically, that's in the outlying districts. Later on, in the year 423, we find, this is paragraph F, it is decreed that in the future no synagogues of the Jews anywhere to be pulled down or burned down. Evidently, they gave him a little more money. And if after decree any cities are seized or consecrated as churches or devoted somewhere to the holy to the holy mysteries, in other words, they change a synagogue into a church. By a new attack, sites of sufficient extent for these places where they can build new synagogues to be furnished for the Jews. In other words, if a church was made, they are not going to reconvert it back to a synagogue. What they'll do is rebuild a new synagogue. Moreover, no further synagogues are to be constructed, and the old ones are to remain in their present state of repair. And this became Roman law for all time. And that's why throughout the Middle Ages it was so hard for Jews to build new synagogues, because they based their law on the old original Roman law. And this Theodosian code was this preceded the Justinian code, but this was the basis of how the Christian authorities, secular authorities, viewed the Jews. Don't destroy their synagogues, but they shouldn't repair them, and they shouldn't build new ones. Up until now, though, they didn't interfere in the actual practice of Judaism. By the time of Justinian, though, he began to tamper with the practice of Judaism itself. Again, you could read the time doesn't allow, so you could read how he wanted to tamper with Passover. One thing that had permanent effect, which will be the subject of a subsequent lecture, and we'll go through all of this in greater detail, is the fact that he forbade the Jews from studying Torah. This is something which had not been done since the time of Hadrian, was already reenacted by Justinian. But they allowed them to pray. So in order to avoid this problem, what the Jews did was they incorporated Torah law in their prayers, and this was the beginning of the piyutim, of the poems were added to the prayers. And if you'll notice, much of them, especially around Passover time and Shkolim, have many laws. The beginning of the introduction of poems that were means of a covert means of teaching developed as a response to the Justinian law forbidding them to study Torah. And this is how the Piyutim, these long poems, began, which is the subject of a further lecture. I just want to give you just a sense of what is happening. We went through the military and political history. We went through their internal history, their internal religious history and their struggles. We're going now through, just in the brief moments, of how they struggled against the Jews. And the first one was against the synagogue. And the final form it took was, we're not going to destroy you, but we're not going to let you build. Because as we quoted the first three, so St. Ambrose and St. Jerome, St. John Chrysostom, says, the synagogue is the enemy of the church. And this is how they have looked at this. And it's important just to understand the view, how Christians view Jews through the centuries, was based on these foundations. When we speak about Christian hatred to Jews, it's not something that was just created by Adolf Hitler. This is the result of hundreds and hundreds of years of indoctrination. There was a struggle against the patriarch. This is the next section. The patriarch, this is the Nasi. We've studied him in previous years. He sent out, as you see in the beginning, he sent out people. There were times he sent out people. He sent out shluchim. He sent out emissaries throughout the area, which was the Christian world, under his control. Part of it was to teach. And this is Jerome, because Mishnah has sent out patriarchs of Jews to this day. Part of it was a defense against Christianity. Part of it was to raise funds. And the Christians did not like this. On beginning of page 6, we quote here St. John Chrysostom again, a great lover of the Jews. Do they not have much abundance of wealth? Does not their patriarch, collecting all their tribute from everywhere, possess boundless treasures? And again, it's referring to the fact that monies were collected throughout the Roman world to support the patriarch, who took that money in turn for the internal government of the Jews and to support yeshivas. Is the race not forward, shameless, quarrelsome, impetuous, bellicose? And this was a work called Against the Jews and Gentiles. And again, do not speak to me of these patriarchs, St. John Chrysostom writes, dealers and traders full of iniquity. I mean, they looked at them as business people. Basically, they were collecting money and maybe made investments. So they could use that money to support what was left of Torah after all the attempts of the Romans and the Christians to destroy it. And it's because of people like St. John Chrysostom we could understand on paragraph D on page 6, again, this must be due to Jewish pressure and monies, bribes that were spent, that there's an official letter from Arcadius. From Arcadius was the son of Theodosius the First. He was the Eastern Roman Emperor. Says, if you dare speak slanderously in public about the illustrious patriarchs, someone let him be subjected to punishment. This was the Jewish way of trying to use the Roman influence, the governmental influence, to protect the Jews. The end was, of course, that the Jews, despite that, you can read through this, as you should take this home and read this with you, were finally denied their rights. The patriarch was stripped of much of his power. This is in page, this is in the year, this is in the year 415 on paragraph G. And finally, on the top of page 7, we find that there is no more any patriarch, and any monies that were used, that were the tax that was used to support the patriarch and his activities, which means the yeshivas, were now to be confiscated from the Jews and put into their general fund. And this was the end of the patriarchs. And this was, and it's interesting that Rabban Gamliel, as you see on page, Rabban Gamliel, the last Gamliel, is mentioned by name. Just briefly, again, they tried to destroy the Jews economically. The first one is that by Constantine, if any Jew has purchased or circumcised a Christian slave, or any of other sect than his own, he shall not keep the circumcised slave in servitude. By law, a Jew who buys a slave must circumcise the slave and make the slave a Jew, a quasi-Jew. They forbade this. Under Constantinus, this is Constantine's son, it came with a death penalty. In fact, it seems from the reading of it that if anyone became a convert and they were involved, there would be a death penalty. These laws weren't always kept, and Jews, again, tried to do what they could to avoid. Basically, in a slave society, if you didn't have slaves, you didn't have employees. I mean, there were very few free employees. I mean, it was work was done by slaves. The final edict was, I mean, what came, and it was basically the final law, is that Jews may own pagan slaves, they may not own Christian slaves. The fear is that the Jews would have a bad influence over Christians. Again, this is part of the, they looked at the struggle against the Jew. And they tried, this is the Christians tried to, I mean, there was conversion against Jews. Jews became Christians. And we see that they tried, the Jews tried what they could to stop it. And there was Roman law against this. And they describe, they arrest him, says this is, it's a fascinating kind of, they arrest him while he's perusing the Gospels, they confiscate the book, they seize the man, this is about someone who's converted to Christianity, drag him along the ground and shouting with no merely casual abuse, they lead him off to the synagogue and whip him. This is referring to Jews against other Jews who have Christian leanings, who have become Christians. And this was described by the saint Epiphanius, it seems, was a Jew himself, who was a Christian, who was a converted Jew, and described what Jews did. And there were all kinds of laws to prevent Jews from reconverting Christians. Now, there's a Jew who became a Christian, and now another Jew tries to reconvert him back, and they can't convert, but to bring him back to Judaism, says there will be severe penalties. In fact, if you have on paragraph B in the bold print, they are to be put to flames and burned if they do this. But despite all their efforts, I'm keeping the last quote here is from Jerome, how few princes of the church there are from the Jews. Still, relative to their numbers, very few Jews really entered the priesthood and became bishops. Usually, says there was a struggle on both ways. The Christians tried to convert the Jews. The Jews, on the other hand, were prevented from trying to convert Christians. One interesting facet we find, again, if you look at yourself on section 6, is the church constantly made laws that Jews should not marry Christians. And evidently there was a problem of intermarriage then. Maybe because of this problem that maybe that's why the Jews really had this suffering. They were afraid of the Jews. They were afraid of Jewish influence. The Jews socially were very close to the non-Jewish world, at least in many places. And because of this fear, and because of this basic hatred, it resulted in all kinds of legislation. The final, and again, it's worthwhile to look here in section 8, but individual rights and religious freedom. Originally, there was complete freedom of religion for everyone. And in the Edict of Milan, which was an edict which Constantine, together with Licinius, his co-emperor at the time, said, so we cannot command religion, for no one believes against his will under compulsion. There was freedom of religion. And eventually they banned paganism and they banned heresy, but they did not ban Judaism. They made it difficult to be a Jew. They took away their rights. And it says Theodosius the Great, and there's the one who is on the timeline, he wrote in paragraph B, it is evident the Jewish sect is not prohibited by any law. Be therefore seriously concerned to learn the Jewish means of banned in certain localities. The church banned them. But the Roman government itself, through Jewish influence, at least tried to keep the Jew as a tolerated subject. Augustine writes of the Jews, again, in their inferior status, but he writes that it's God's will that the Jews shall persist. And says even Augustine, writing to Jerome, says no one should forbid Jews from practicing Judaism, although Christian teaching would not compel them to do so. Augustine felt that Jews should have the freedom of religion, and that really came out in the final law, which we have in paragraph D. Says that Jews are allowed to be citizens, but they were stripped of all dignities and honors. And again, that was generally, this created what was then became policy throughout the Roman Empire until the emancipation. Jews were tolerated. They were not allowed to hold any office. Up until they were not allowed to be soldiers. Until the emancipation, in the 1800s. But again, all of this started from the Byzantine Empire. And that's from this. All that we have, all these histories and the attitudes of the government to the Jews and the church to the Jews were formed in this critical era of history. What's noteworthy is that despite all of this, and we have on page 10, during this period Jerusalem was not allowed, was off limits to Jews. They describe once a year on Tisha B'Av, Jews were allowed to go to a certain section near the Beis HaMikdash, because that was all. But they basically were not allowed in Yerushalayim. And even those Jews who remained in Israel were in other cities. They were in Gaza, they were in Tiberias, they were in Soar, which is in the south of Israel, Negev. They were not allowed in Jerusalem. And yet, despite this, they had synagogues and they prayed. And it's clear from the last two quotations we have that there were scholars in Israel that were quoted in Talmudic times. This is the first. This is at the end. This is in the this is about the year 506. This is prior to Justinian. But this is already what we've read before had come into effect. But still, there seem to be scholars of Israel that are quoted in the Talmud. And later on, after Justinian, this is in the timeline, Marzutra, the son of Marzutra, says left Babylon and came to be the Resh Pirka, and this be the head of the yeshiva in Israel. So what's an amazing thing is about the Jews. They were not allowed to build new synagogues. There were all kinds of attacks on the synagogues that had the Roman law had to be reiterated. You're not allowed to do that, which is basically saying that it actually happened. And we know there's all kinds of records of burnings of synagogues and attacks on synagogues. They were discriminated against. They were stripped of all privileges. The patriarch no longer could function. Monies that came to support the yeshivas that came from all over the empire were not allowed to go to Israel anymore. They weren't allowed to have Christians. Most of them were, this is a Christian world already. So we're not having Christian slave basically said you didn't have a slave. So economically they were discriminated against because it was very hard to get regular in that society. It was just very, very hard to get a regular worker. And despite all of this, they composed the piyutim, they composed these prayers, they came to the synagogue, they studied in yeshivas. It's a tremendous tribute to the Jewish people. I just want just to summarize in 1 minute what we went through tonight. We went through the discussion of how the Roman Empire from its zenith began to collapse till finally the whole western side was taken over by Germans. The eastern side, which developed its own flavor, it was Greek, was also harassed from all sides. And finally, but it lasted after the fall of Rome another 1,000 years in a much, much reduced form. Christianity and its doctrines took their final form during the period of the struggles here in the 300-400s. And we've discussed the struggles of the questions of the doctrines of, is it one, is it three, is it a son, was it created, is it one nature, is it two natures? And all the while they were busy struggling amongst themselves, there was also the struggle against the Jews, against the synagogues, against the patriarch, against their livelihood. We've survived. I'm interested. Next week, 2 weeks from now, we will discuss. We've discussed the creation of the Byzantine Empire and the Catholic and the Orthodox Church. We will discuss next time about the creation of Islam. Okay. Yeah. No, wait. Just there are two quotes here. The one from the Gemara, right, is in the year 506, which is in the time of the Rabbonin Savaroy, right. The last quote was at the very end of the period of the Rabbonin Savaroy, where a son of the Resh Galusa because, again, the problems with the Persians emigrated from Babylon, from Iraq to Eretz Yisrael. No, that's the patriarch. That's the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael. The Reish Galusa was the name of the Jewish political head who was a descendant of King David in Babylon, in Iraq. The Nasi, who was the descendant of Hillel, that was the one that was abolished by Theodosius II. Oh, yeah. Okay. Tariqa. In terms of the first question, the Christianity had a tremendous appeal at that time for people, that it was very moral. Paganism had lost its appeal. There were many converts to Judaism at the time, and there were people not fully converted to Judaism, but Judaism itself had a tremendous appeal to people. Josephus describes, and this is in the time that by the destruction of the Second Temple, in the year 70, 80, 90, about non-Jews that kept Shabbos, even though they weren't truly Jews, or kept kashrus. So there was an appeal of that kind of life. But the Christianity really as a major movement only became really successful when Constantine, the Roman Emperor, embraced it. He made it law. And when you have the law on your side, it works pretty well. Judaism, your second question, is a religion that generally does not actively go after proselytes, after gerim. Because Geras is something which is a conviction of the spirit. Someone who comes is generally asked to rethink this and to tell them how difficult it is. By the fact also that the Jews were always, since the destruction of the Temple, I mean even before, second-class citizens, it did not make Judaism that appealing to be a second-class citizen. And having such a rigorous life and so regimented really was less appealing than being a Christian, where you had the monotheism generally, at least close to monotheism, and morality and justice in a much easier way. The third question about these issues, why aren't they dealt with, they are. I mean, they definitely are. The answer they say is that these are the mysteries of the church, and it defies human understanding. That's really is what they're saying. So they have a certain level of struggle with it as well. I mean, it's not to say that these are really problems. They try to answer this way and that way, but the ultimate answer is it really defies human understanding. Yeah. I don't know about the numbers of Jews who became Christians. My sense is, in reading the histories, relative to their numbers, the vast majority of Jews did not become Christians. There are different theories. The facts are few. The theories are many. There is one theory, maybe this is what you're alluding to. The Christianity of the earliest church and the apostles was different than the Christianity that was espoused by Paul, that eventually became what we know as today as Christianity. The original Christians, James and the others, kept the Torah. It was a religion of Jews. It was a messianic Jewish religion. The religion of Paul was a universal religion. It did not really require, for the observance of mitzvahs is no longer required. and B, the idea of circumcision of, in terms of creating the conversion is no longer required. It was easier to become a convert, and it was and the conversion itself was much more appealing.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.